Test volume check, volume check, volume check for press box. Volume check for press box. Is that good, guys? All right.
And thank you. And I'm on.
So it's always probably a good idea to kind of settle the room down with a good joke to get started. And it's also always a pretty good idea for that joke to, you know, to have real relevance to the topic that you're going to talk about that particular day. And so this slide is not up here to represent this, you know, three economists. This is basis for the joke, you know. So, you know, one of the things that economists do is try to make sure they ask the good question, the probing question. So the other day, myself and a couple buds go out on, you know, I live on a golf course. I won't say that I live for golf, but I golf for, anyway. We stroll out there and we're on the first tee and these guys are about, you know, 125, 130 yards out there, whatever. And they're taking freaking forever. I mean, they find the ball, they hit the ball, it's about 10 yards, they take forever to find the ball, you know, and we're like, I can see the ball from here, it's right, go to the ball. So about that time, Billy comes running out, the pro, and he says, guys, I'm so sorry. I let these guys play, you know, whenever they come, I try to make sure I get them out as soon as I can, but you remember the fire that we had in the pro shop about 18 months ago? Like, yeah, okay, it all burned down to the ground. Yes, but the firefighters came out and put the fire out. But remember that the fire got to those Srixon titanium core golf balls, and the heat was so intense that titanium gas came out, and they didn't have face masks on. It got in their eyes, and it blinded them. But they still got the fire out, say the pro shop. And these are those guys. These are those very firefighters. You know, they were blinded by that, and so they're blind. So that's why they're playing so slow. It takes them forever to find the ball. Okay. So John, you know, our local optometrist, you know, he says, oh, God, I've read about this in other places where this has happened. It doesn't happen very often, but it does. But they've done research. They figured out it's the nerve bundle at the back. I can get those guys in the office on Monday morning. And by Saturday morning, you know, they're playing golf. That's what we do on Saturday morning. And we can fix this problem. I think we can get these guys' sight restored by Tuesday. I think we can have them back in shape. We'll get them right in there. Pro bono, we'll just do it. Great. Dave, the local Baptist minister, he's like, by gosh, we will have a prayer meeting tomorrow morning. I can fix these guys on Sunday, by gosh. We'll just bring them in, lay the hands on, heal. We'll have them fixed by Sunday. Bob, the local economist, steps up to Billy and says, why can't these guys play at night? And that's what economists do, ask those probing questions. Well, I appreciate the opportunity for us to be in front of you guys today. I will tell you, typically we don't put Farm Bureau staff up at annual meeting. That's just something that historically we don't do very often. So when the opportunity came along and they said, okay, you got three slots, we'll do the livestock outlook and do the crops outlook. What do you want to do in the third outlook? Nobody said anything. I said, well, I'll take it. So our opportunity here is to basically put our economics team up in front of you. And we've been very fortunate through time. I'm going to actually introduce these folks in kind of the reverse order that they're going to talk to you about. So each one of them is only going to talk about, you know, 8-10 minutes or so. So just kind of little snippets, just almost a speed dating introduction, if you will. We've had Veronica and I with Farm Bureau since about 2011. We were very fortunate to get her from Foreign Agricultural Service. Veronica was one of those folks that sat in the room in Geneva as the WTO negotiations were going on, listened to what the proposals were, would go back to the office at the evening, figure out what the implications of those proposals were, present that back to the negotiators so that they could figure out what they wanted to do the next morning or so. Master's degree in agricultural economics from University of Missouri, so I kind of have a personal, but anyway, we'll go from there. Caitlin McCulloch, we got her on board in June this year. Very fortunate to bring her on board. She did a lot of work with Farm Credit East as a farm consultant. One of those that actually went out on the farm and sat down with folks, talked about business plans, what they needed to do for workouts, that kind of stuff, things of that nature. She, before that, was at the Livestock Market Information Center out in Colorado and got her master's degree in agricultural economics from Colorado State University as well. John Newton, Dr. Newton, we actually kind of stole John from National Milk Producers Federation. He was chief economist over there. We brought him on board again also in June of 2016. You hear these stories about there's only five people in the world that actually really understand federal milk market orders. And he's one of those five, so I think we're very fortunate to get him on board. Also was at University of Illinois. Anybody here actually look at FarmDoc on a daily basis? I do, but was one of those folks that worked on that system as well, and very fortunate to have him. Was with the USDA's Ag Marketing Service for about 10 years or so before that. When I originally put this slide together, I had that as a small T before the Ohio State University, but somebody else got a hold of these slides and made some adjustments. Louisville native son, and trust me, he's got the gloves and the whole nine yards up in the office and goes from there. So that's really our economics team at this point in time. Again, fairly new, or at least half of it, only been on board for about 6 months or so, but been very impressed with these guys and their abilities in the time that we've had them on board. Caitlin's kind of gotten dumped in the fire on a couple issues that I'm not going to mention because I'd really just as soon not talk about today and go from there. I'm only going to put up one economic slide for my conversation. And as I said, one of the things that economists do is ask those probing questions. I'd also say that they make the really obvious statements that, I did have an obvious man slide that I was going to put up, but I decided not to do that. You're not making as much money today as you were making 2 or 3 years ago. I bet you didn't know that, did you? Yeah, that's those economists for you, just pointing things out. But we've kind of returned to where, if you were in the livestock session, we talked about that historically folks consume 50 pounds of pork, and we're getting farm income back down to about that $65 billion range or so, real terms, which is kind of where farm income tends to sit most times until we end up once in a while getting lucky, getting a blip, or on the other hand, as we did in the 80s, flipping the other way. But I would remind us that where we are today is kind of noticeably different than where we were, say back in the 1980s, 1990s or whatever, when we were at the $65 billion numbers. I would remind us that we've actually brought on board between the Black Sea region, for example, and Russia, the Ukraine, in South America, since about 1990, we have actually brought on board almost 200 million acres of production. That's almost the size of U.S. agriculture. That's a huge additional amount of supply that's out there rumbling through the system. We've also talked about ethanol demand going from, a little under a billion bushels or so to 5 billion bushels worth of demand for corn. So the demand side has also increased substantially. I'd also say if you go back to the 1980s, probably a quarter to a third or so of all of our lending was provided by folks that, by non-commercial lending, by Uncle George, Grandma Sue or whatever, provided us about a third to a quarter or so of our lending. Today that, non-commercial lending is down to about, it's like in sixth or seventh place or whatever, it's less than 5%. So all of our lending at this stage of the game is pretty much a commercial loan. So you've got to have a business plan behind it. You've also got folks that are, probably going to be more than willing to say, I'm sorry, I'm not going to lend to you anymore. As opposed to Grandma Sue that would have said, we'll carry you for another year and just kind of continue to suck down on equity or whatever you were doing to kind of stay in business. So just, again, Got to have a strong business plan in place, all that kind of good stuff that, again, back in the 80s or so, didn't necessarily have to have. I'd also say that, as I mentioned, we've got this tremendous increase in supply. We've also got this tremendous increase in demand. And I think that puts us in a position where the potential for price volatility is probably as great, if not greater today, than it has been in times past. And with that, I'm going to turn things over to John. What? Go back. That's right. I'm supposed to go back, and you're picking this up from there, aren't you? Yeah, there we go. Okay.
All right. Can you hear me? All right. Thanks a lot, Bob. I appreciate it. It is the Ohio State University. Unfortunately, we didn't show up in the championship game against Clemson. I'm from Louisville, so I'm a big Louisville Cardinals fan, and we did get a Heisman Trophy winner, so I am happy about that. So I'm just going to jump right in. Bob talks about net farm income down for a third year in a row, and what I want to do is just hit on three kind of fundamental things. I want to hit on something on supply, talk a little bit about demand, and then talk about price. So when we think about supply and kind of how we got to where we are today, go back to 2010-11, go back to December 2006 when the renewable fuel standard really kicked into high gear. We saw demand on the grain side increasing globally, whereas on the global supply side, we had several short crops in a row. The implication of having several short crops when demand is growing is that we saw commodity prices and net farm income hit record highs. Corn price per bushel hit a record high in 2012. We saw soybean prices reach record highs. Commodity prices in general on the dairy side saw record highs shortly after that. But what happens? Anybody know, you've heard this saying, the cure for high prices is high prices. So look what's happened since. We've seen just supply growth continue to outpace the growth in demand. The change in global grain and oilseed supply since 2000 is up 56%, whereas the change in demand is up about 53%. So we've had four crop years now where we're building inventories, not only in the United States, but across the world. And that's put negative price pressure. That's led to lower commodity prices and led to that decline in net farm income. One of the other things on the supply side that I think is very important to understand is that the old adage of big crops are going to get bigger is going to continue. Just through technology advancement alone, if you look at, you know, we're going to have a record corn yield. USDA's report next week, or this week on Thursday, should confirm that corn yield is going to be about 175 bushels per acre. Just think historically, in 1960, it would have taken 260 million acres to produce the corn crop we're producing today. So we're going to do it this year with 86 million acres harvested. And if we continue to see the productivity gains in yield, in 40 years, we'll be able to do it with 20 million fewer acres. But we're going to continue to plant those acres. So we're going to continue to see these big crops get bigger. So the supply side will continue to apply that pressure on prices. And that leads into the demand side. And one of the things I've heard, you know, I was in the livestock section, I was in the crop section, and we talk about demand. And Bob's right. Demand, we're consuming everything that we're producing. We're consumption's at record highs. Just on the biofuel side domestically, however, it's starting to slow down. I mean, ethanol consumption is flat. You can see that here. About 40% of the corn that's produced goes into ethanol. We do see some growth on that soybean oil use going into biodiesel. But in general, the biofuel boom is over. It's a consistent user of corn, but it's not a growing category. Livestock and residual use is a fairly flat category. So the other category that we need to focus on, and I've heard this time and time again, is trade. And how important is trade to the U.S. farm economy? So what this map shows is it changes the proportion of each state based on their importance with respect to that relative data set. So here, you know, Illinois, we export a lot of corn and soybeans. So the shape of Illinois has changed. California, they export a lot of horticultural products, livestock, dairy products. So California's changed. And what you could see is that trade is very important to U.S. agriculture. In 2015, trade contributed $133 billion to U.S. farm income. And we could see how important it is to our market, because our domestic market is fairly mature. As Bob mentioned, you know, we're consuming 50 pounds of pork a year on average. That's not a growing category. The growing categories are going to be overseas. And so then we think about, well, where do we do business? This is that same map, but now I've changed every country in the world based on where we operate, where we sell our products. Where do you think the most important market for ag is? Somebody said China. China, NAFTA, Canada, Mexico, and Japan. Those four markets represent over 50% of our ag trade. And some of those markets are fairly mature as well. In the previous session, somebody said the Canadians aren't really growing, are they? And so it's some of these other markets that are going to provide the opportunities. Market access is key in some of these other markets. So we think about where we were. We were in TPP. You know, that was a trade agreement that we were, you know, highly involved in. And how important is TPP? So this map, now what we're showing is population growth. All right, so it's changing where population growth is. Where do we think the future customers are going to be? Can you find China on that map? That's right. Can you find India on that map?
Yeah.
A little bit. Can you find us on that map? Where's the United States? So where's our domestic market? Is it growing? We rely on China to take in 1/4 of every acre of soybeans. Pork exports to China doubled this year, but they're not a growing market. The population growth in China is not expected to be what it is in Africa, what it is in this TPP region. So that's why market access is critically important, developing those new markets so that we can reach our new customers. And now this is my favorite one, because now I've changed it to show where's ag produced. So now we're the breadbasket of the world. Everybody knows that. But as Bob mentioned, we've seen acres come online in South America and then China. Not to discount them. They're the number two producer of corn. They're the number one producer of pork. So these are big ag markets. And it's important to recognize the importance of trade and what that means for growing our markets and getting rid of some of these commodities and finding new markets. And kind of hitting on the last point is, you know, recognizing the volatility, the volatile market that we're in, where we have growing supplies, demand is critically important. The final piece to that puzzle is price. The final piece is marketing decisions. And so who locked in corn at $4.50? Who'd sell corn for $4.50 today? So if we just go back historically, this is the new crop corn contract going back to when it came on the board. Started around $5.50, ended at $3.50 per bushel. But in the spring, we had weather concerns, dryness in the Corn Belt. There was concerns about an La Nina. That led corn prices up to $4.50. That's right about the time I joined Farm Bureau. I'm not going to brag about what's happened since I joined Farm Bureau. but the key is to recognize the kind of environment that we're now in and think about how we can manage risk, how we can make effective marketing decisions, seize the marketing opportunities when they become available. And can you make money at $4.50? You know, these are the kind of decisions that you need to think about, recognize the environment that we're in. Because it's a new paradigm. The golden age of ag income is over. So we need to think about marketing decisions, finding those new customers, recognizing that price is very sensitive to supply shocks. The domestic markets, again, they're fairly mature, and so trade growth is key to expanding our markets. think the UN has a phrase, feed the nine billion people by 2050, and as the breadbasket of the world, that's an opportunity for us. And finally, I think risk management and marketing is key, finding opportunities to manage price risk, to lock in some sort of positive return on your investment. And then think about other ways to evaluate your operation and find efficiencies and profitability. I think that's what Caitlin and Veronica are going to come up and talk to you about next. So, Caitlin.
Thank you, John. So Dr. Young and Dr. Newton have spent some time talking to you guys about the overall farm economy. And I'm going to shift our focus back down to the farm level. I like to think of businesses in largely three different operational mantras. Some of us are revenue maximizers. We focus on getting the highest revenue possible every year. Others of us really work on minimizing costs. That's what our focus is keeping those inputs tight. And then still other business owners work on volatility, minimizing the ups and downs in their net farm income. But all three of those mantras deal with extreme price volatility. And as John mentioned, it's a big concern, and it should be. But for the next 10 minutes, I'm going to ask you to kind of put those worries aside and think about what types of things can you do without worrying about price. And to do that and help frame the conversation, I'm going to offer you a price guarantee. So let's imagine what your operation would look like if it wasn't the best year, if it wasn't the worst year, but just kind of the average net return for the next 5 to 10 years, okay, in terms of prices. What kind of management decisions would you make to increase that margin if prices weren't going to change? Well, when I was a business consultant, one of the tools we used was benchmarking to do this. Anytime we're going to talk about increasing margins, probably the first thing we hit is cost minimization. Now, there's two ways to really look at benchmarking. The first one is just on your operation, comparing your operation over time to itself. And what that's going to do is going to line up your income statement year over year and look at the trends and expenses. So I want you to notice what you're looking for is big trends. So something that wouldn't happen with a year-to-year price increase or price decrease. This is going to tell you what things are going to go up, what things are going to go down. Now, if you do that and you notice some expenses going up, you want to have a good reason. You want to think behind that reason. Was it a change in my management style, or are we getting a little loose with what we're doing with inputs? If they're trending down, that's not necessarily good either, right? It could be an employee cutting corners when they shouldn't, using less supplies. It can also be a bookkeeping thing, right? Is that miscellaneous category growing at the same rate those expenses are shrinking? But this is going to help identify some of the costs that you can probably just click right off and help increase that margin. The second way you can benchmark is comparing yourself to the overall industry. And this is where professionals can really help you, because they're going to help identify those normal ranges of some metrics. And the things you're going to look at here are going to be probably more production-based. You know, where's my calf mortality compared to others in my production system or region? What kind of produce am I getting? Sales per square retail feet. Those are the types of things you're going to look at. Now, I think this can be scary for some folks because it's hard to know kind of where you measure up, right? Somebody has to be on the bottom. Someone has to be in the bottom 25%. But I don't want you to be scared of this, because pretty often you're going to have, almost everyone has things that they're really good at and some things they need to work on. But usually what happens is they look at that top 25% group and notice where they're at, and they say, how's that guy doing that? He's in my same area. He's my same production system. How is he getting a dollar more per hundredweight than I am? Or how is he only at 1% calf mortality and I'm at 3? Those are the types of things that get you thinking about what kind of changes can you make on your operation and how can I get into that top 25%. Now, in terms of stacking up against each other, very rarely are you going to see a farm with all across the board bottom 25%, right? If you're in that category, there's going to be some sign points you've probably seen on your operation well before you get to benchmarking. But the important thing to know too is just because you compare yourself doesn't really change the metric. If you make $100,000 in rent farm income, but the group made 50, it doesn't change that you made $100,000. It might make you feel better, but it hasn't actually changed your income. And similarly, if you make $100,000, but all your peers are making $200,000, you might think, what are they doing differently? How can I learn from them? For those of us that are less metrically inclined, I know not everyone's an economist or an accountant. SWOT analysis is another option. Has anyone ever heard of SWOT? Okay, good, a few hands. So SWOT stands for strengths, weaknesses, opportunities, and threats. And this one's pretty easy to set up. All you need is a piece of paper. You're gonna divide it into four quadrants and put each of these words in each quadrant. And what you're gonna aim is to think of about three items to go in each of these boxes. And what this is gonna help you do is ask yourself internal and external factors, things I can control versus things I can't control. For internal factors, these are your strengths and weaknesses. So you're gonna ask yourself, what does my operation do well? You don't need your income statement to tell you this. You can probably think of a few things that you think you do pretty well and put those in the box. Maybe it's you produce high quality produce. For weaknesses, again, things you can affect. Maybe you have high employee turnover. What kind of things can you work on? For external factors, these are the opportunities and the threats. You're gonna wanna think about your community or your environment or regulations, things that you personally cannot affect on your farm, cannot affect about your environment. So these types of opportunities would be the buy local movement. Maybe you don't do any direct marketing now, but maybe that's an opportunity you could look into. Some threats might be a new regulation you're gonna have to deal with. I mean, these are things you're gonna have to plan for and adapt to, but they should still be, let's say, in the realm of possibilities. You know, if you live in Vermont, maybe tornado doesn't belong in your threat category because it's not going to happen. But if you are, you know, if you raise chickens and HiPath AI is next door, that's a pretty serious threat. You're going to have to up your biosecurity probably. Now, both of these analysis techniques are about identifying areas where you can maybe affect your management and increase your bottom line. And it's sometimes a little more difficult to identify the how. You might be able to pick out a couple of things that you really want to impact here, and how you do that is important. And unfortunately, there is no magic bullet. I hate to say it, but there's not. But here's a couple of things that I want to talk about that are that I think every operation, regardless of what industry you're in, can work on, and that's genetics and technology. Now, genetics is one that we think about probably pretty often, but I think it also can be overlooked to some extent. So pretty often we're focused on more production, higher yields. And the American farmer, you can see that in these charts. So this year we saw record high corn and soybean yields. We had a 5% increase year over year in pings per liter. And milk per cow continues to grow. And I could probably put this chart up six more times about other industries, and we're continuously focusing on that. And that's important too. But maybe in this new lower net farm income, we wanna shift our focus to efficiency. So instead of focusing on higher production and higher yields, maybe we wanna look at lower inputs. How can I get the same production, but lower the cost that it takes to get there? The things that are gonna fall into that are like feed efficiency, right, on animals. The other thing I would mention in this area is genomic testing, right? That lowers the variability across genetics. Another thing I think of here is maybe changing the way we make replacement decisions on breeding operations. I know we probably all have a checklist we go through, you know, and if she hits all those boxes, there she goes. But maybe we think about reevaluating those or changing the amount of time for when we cull those animals, either shorter or longer. So just some things to think about. Technology, technology is a wonderful thing. I think John put up a chart that showed technology moves pretty fast. Here, I think we should be looking at technology that affects labor. I've never met a farmer that said they wanted to manage more people, right? Sometimes there's not enough labor. Sometimes labor you have doesn't have the skills you want. And sometimes there's just a lot of paperwork, right? So anytime we're talking about labor and technology efficiencies, we're talking about automatic feeders, robots to reduce the number of time we're handling different items. In greenhouses, this can be important. Automatic feeders, those are or even just a bigger tractor. The less times you got to cross that field, it's going to reduce those labor. So the important thing, kind of we've been talking about here, is these are all strategies you can use regardless of what the price is doing. These are looking outside that box of what if prices do this, what if prices do that. These can have a long-term impact on your operation. As much as I wish I could guarantee you a price that would be reasonable, I think the important thing is to remain flexible and adaptable. To drill down into some of these numbers, and I think we tend to do really well at things we focus on every single day. So the thing I look at every single week on my operation is probably one of those things I do pretty good at. And I encourage you to kind of look outside those boxes a little bit. I think you might be surprised at some of the opportunities that you find. Thank you.
Are you guys clapping for Caitlin, or are you clapping because I'm coming up? Either way is fine. So Dr. Young started us off at about a 50-year horizon. Dr. Newton came in a little bit closer and talked about these long-term sort of trends that we see going on in supply and demand. And Caitlin got us a little bit closer in this 4 to 5 year range, things that you can do to try to improve your operation. I'd like to get a little bit closer and talk about things that you can do in the next year or two. If we think about this sort of low commodity price trend continuing, unfortunately, for the next few years, what's old is new again. We're going to start thinking about things like maximizing our cash and preserving it by reducing cost, and then also by diversifying. Yet again, Bob mentioned earlier that economists like to state the obvious, and I'm going to do that for a few more minutes. So the last few years, I think, when commodity prices were good, we were all focused on certain things that Caitlin mentioned. And we were doing a good job farming. And then things happen that are really out of our control. Good production happens all over the world. And I think we can all relate to this GIF just a little bit. Can't we? He didn't go. Okay, so I'll animate it for you. This gentleman right here is feeding these otters. And over here on the left, no, Bob's going to animate it. What a team. So here on the left is this otter. This is what we were doing during good times. We were focused over here. And we've kind of turned our back on this otter to the right. Well, he comes up and steals the bucket. I'm so sorry you guys don't see this, because it's really cute. He comes and steals this bucket. And I think that's a little bit how we all feel about what's happened the last few years. So the first thing I'd like to talk about is that tax avoidance and tax evasion are not the same thing. We need to think about strategies to avoid taxes over the next few years, ways we can preserve that cash. One of those things, a lot of these things are you've been doing all these years. Prepayments on inputs, deferred payment on inputs. Accountants are nice people. They're very good at what they do. We need them, but they're not necessarily the most strategic people I've ever met. So I would encourage you to try to take some of these decisions into your own hands. There's a website, ruraltax.org, that gives like 3 to 4 page summaries of different strategies on different topics. One of those that I would think about is 179, Section 179 depreciation. Man alive, we had a big win a few years ago. We bumped that level up to $500,000 and made it permanent. That's a really good thing. But just because you have, it's kind of like hanging a picture. If you need to put that nail in the wall, just because you have a sledgehammer doesn't mean you need to use that sledgehammer to put that nail in the wall. Maybe that small hammer is it. So I'll give you an example of this. Just because you have 179 doesn't mean you have to use all of it. So let's say Caitlin decides to start a greenhouse. She spends $35,000 building a greenhouse. But she goes in and talks to her tax professional, and he's like, Caitlin, only $10,000 of that, that's all you really need. Only take that $10,000 and then spread the other $25,000 over, depreciated over the next few years. You'd be surprised how many people, because they know they can depreciate the entire amount, do it, even if it's not necessarily in their best interest. Or things like if, unfortunately, you would have a loss this year. There's different ways you can approach a loss. You can approach a loss through your Section F, or you can think about it as an income loss, but those two different things have different rules on how they're calculated and how far back you can go. So think about it from that perspective. I would also mention that this year, there's been a lot of noise about maybe finally doing comprehensive tax reform, something we haven't done in 30 years. Pat Wolf has a panel of folks in here at 1 o'clock in this room at 1 o'clock today to think about, to discuss different ways changes in the tax code may have an impact on your bottom line. I'd suggest that you might come in here for that. Another really obvious thing is think about your farm debt. A lot of folks used cash when cash was plentiful to buy machinery and real estate. It might be time to refinance. And sometimes you're really good, as Caitlin mentioned, we're really good at focusing on the things we do every day. But you know, if you were one of these folks who bought here in 2007, the black line is your average effective interest rate on non-real estate loans. Your orange here is your real estate loan rate. So if you were here in 2007 and you bought a property, the average rate was a little over 8%. Today we're still sitting at about 4%, but we've already had a rate increase recently, and we'd expect to have another few in 2017. So it may be time, as Bob mentioned, some banks are starting to tighten up, but there's others. The Kansas City Fed, when I was looking at their sort of usage, they only report like two banks in the Kansas City area of having turned away folks because they didn't have enough credit. So if you're in this situation where you haven't yet refinanced, and I know a lot of you probably have, but this can be a sleeper way to find some cash. Does anybody recognize this slogan? I'm gonna move from the discussion of minimizing costs to maybe potentially a couple of outlets to increase revenue. So get your side hustle on. That's Uber. We've all used Uber. The other day I got in an Uber in DC and the guy, we were chatting and he said, it just came out that he was actually had ran the Maryland governor's race the last time around. His candidate won, but the season was over and he was waiting for the next campaign cycle to come through. So he was driving Uber in the meantime. There's no reason that we can't do that in our industry as well. So, you know, as we're thinking about commodity prices, there not being many safe havens out there right now, diversification can be a tool. One of those, if you're in the fruit and veg area, is sort of focusing here on the CSA path. Consumers are used to paying up front for things. They'll pay in advance. They do subscription payments. That'll give you, rather than this lump sum that we're all sort of accustomed to, unfortunately, in agriculture, can stretch your revenues out throughout the year. Farm to table, if you're in an area with a fairly sizable consumer base, people like to know where their food comes from. I find that a little overused, but John just brought in the other day, he'd been on vacation, and showed a restaurant board where all of the ingredients that they were using, they showed the source of all the local farms. That's not a trend that's going away. Millennials love to eat out. We don't really like to cook. That's not going to change just because we get older. The restaurant scene, that kind of ties into the same thing. If that's not your jam, what about, we have these large land bases that maybe we've only been utilizing them in for our own benefit. What about things like stocking your fishing pond and turning that into a private lake, having folks come on the farm to do that, or starting a hunting and outfitting operation? Again, we have all this space. So what about thinking about rental space for meetings and gatherings, or offering motorhome, boat, and trailer storage? those of us who live in the suburbs, there are lots of rules about what we can and cannot do outside our houses. Parking an RV or a trailer or a boat are one of those things. And then I grew up on a goat farm. That was not by intention. We got out of the llama business and got into the goat business. We were definitely the funny farm around. We raised a lot of specialist breeds of animals. Goats can be a good companion to maybe another type of livestock that you're doing. If you know that there's a hunting and outfitting operation near you, maybe you raise quail or pheasants. There's a lot of things that we can kind of do to maybe slightly get out of our comfort zone, but you're not going from being a cattle guy to strawberries. And then finally, I know you're tired of hearing us say this, but the export scene. 95% of the world's population lives outside of our borders. I'm doing as much as I possibly can to eat as much meat and dairy as you produce. But I should probably slow that down and do it within reason. So there's lots of folks around the world who would like to have your products. But I think sometimes we talk about 9 billion people, and there's no way to get your arms around that. We grow commodities. We're members, American Farm Bureau and many of the state farm bureaus are members of U.S. Meat Export Federation, U.S. Grains Council, U.S. Soybean Export Council, the U.S. Dairy Export Council, a lot of councils. And they're working hard on your behalf. Definitely take those folks up on it. But there's also this other group of farm organizations that receive government funding to help you export your products. Those are regional groups, Food Export Association of the Midwest, here are these kind of purple states, Food Export Northeast, SESTA, or down here, Western U.S., or the light green. You don't have to get to know the 95% of your customers all by yourself. These organizations will help you get market research. They'll help you with an exporting plan, exploring markets firsthand, meeting with international buyers, exhibiting at international trade shows, and maybe most important, fund match 50% of reimbursable activities. So you don't have to come up with that brochure in Mandarin all by yourself. I mean, maybe you can, but the opportunity costs and all that jazz. These organizations can help you do that. So I would just encourage you to think about, we had some folks a few years ago, was it the third year of the IACs? I chair, from a staff perspective, the Trade IAC. And one of our members was from Nebraska, and he sold popcorn. And he said, you know, if I compete in the U.S., nobody knows my name. It's hard to break into this market. There, you know, you've already got your big popcorn companies. And he said, that's what we were trying to do. But it wasn't working terribly well for all of the obvious reasons. He said, and we were starting to run into trouble. And then he found one of these groups, Food Export Midwest. They helped him do some branding. And now he's second largest exporter of popcorn to China. He said, you know, nobody knows microwave popcorn in China. I can make a name for myself there. So think of it from that perspective. You don't always have to be the biggest guy in town. It doesn't even have to be the most exotic product that's ever existed. But there are folks who haven't ever known your product before. So I'm going to turn it back over to Bob. Thank you very much.
Which way are we going?
Right here. Okay.
So I said when we got started that this was just kind of really very short introductions to these folks. Again, some of which have only been with us for about 6 months or so, but I didn't use a 5-minute video or when we dated because my wife of 40 plus years is in the back of the room. I better not go there. So Veronica and I, these folks work on a lot of other things. You know, they only had 6-8 minutes or so to kind of visit with you this morning. Veronica, as I said, really is our trade economist and has done great jobs. When you hear, for example, when we did our analysis of TPP, you know, it looks to us like it increases farm income by someplace in the $4 to $5 billion range or so. And when we're talking about the income hits that we've got, there's a reason why we're so strongly supportive of TPP. You've heard her talk about tax issues. She did a lot of work on the waters of the U.S. and the environment and the economic implications of waters of the U.S., FSMA. She and Christy have done a lot of work on training programs, for that matter, on FSMA. Also worked on a lot of the economics of ag labor issues and things of that nature. I'd almost say she's our utility infielder, if you will, but she's really willing to take on about any project. Caitlin, again, only been with us for about 6 months. Really, we brought her on board to be our livestock economist, and she's done a great job on that. She's picked up on a lot of kind of contentious issues. If I said catfish, that would probably make her, but she's worked on some catfish insurance issues. She's worked, I'll say this out loud, she's worked on gypsy as well for us quite a bit. And again, kind of this whole kind of farm level financial management issues, et cetera, have been really, really good to have her on board, and will be, I think, very good for us over the course of the next 2 or 3 years. That's almost a forecast of farm economic conditions. Be good for us over the next few years to have her on board working on that as well. Also dealing with organic issues. And then Dr. Newton, kind of our director of market intelligence. Many of you know we put out a couple market outlook publications a month. Caitlin does one on the livestock side. John kind of coordinates that overall effort, does the crop side as well. Been really instrumental on the whole farm bill development process that we've had at the state level. He and Mary Kay worked very hard on that front. Kind of our crop insurance and insurance in general mode. We may have future conversations more about insurance products as time unfolds. We're also going to be working on a new Farm Bureau Economic Information website. We've kind of been lagging behind there, I think, at times past, and John's really going to go a long way toward bringing us up on that. With that, I'll stop. Any questions that folks might have, and I know we've probably hit the time number right on the mark, but might take one or two questions if we got them. And if you don't, I understand that perfectly because, you know, Peyton Manning's coming. Yes, sir. First off, I think I'm not very concerned about that right at the moment. That's not at the top of my list. We have done studies in the past about the impacts of renewable fuel standard enlargement, you know, what it does to farm income, things of that nature. Haven't done anything lately. Again, I think we've gotten enough kind of pushback, enough kind of noise, et cetera, back out of this administration that I'm not so sure that they're going to go off and touch that at this stage of the game. That's not keeping me awake at night. Other questions? Folks, thank you very much. Appreciate the time today. Fine job by all.